Beth, tell me, did you have any experience going on civil action projects at all?
I did.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, we were supposed to go out at least once a week. I did not. I went out a couple of times. And basically you went out into the jungle, and they'd have a wooden building set up, kind of a shack, where people would line up and come in and be seen by a doctor. And there were just all kinds of weird and wonderful things that we saw, stuff that I'd only read about in books.
Like?
Tumors and various blindness and insect-related diseases. And just, I can't really be specific. There were just a lot of things, rashes, stuff that I'd never seen before.
And you said that you were supposed to go out. Was that sort of an unwritten reg or a informal advice from above, or was it actually an order that you were supposed to?
No, it wasn't an order per se, but they'd say basically it was our duty to get out there and do the stuff.
And were you accompanied by any kind of security detail when you would go on these?
I don't remember necessarily. Maybe I'm sure that there must have been somebody who went out with us, but I don't remember.
Who would you go with?
Well, there'd be a doctor and some nurses, okay. An anesthetist or somebody, whatever. There'd be a bunch of us in the Jeep, and off we'd go, or a couple of Jeeps.
When I've interviewed other people, I'm thinking particularly of a battalion surgeon who did these med caps. He said that it just felt completely futile, and he got fed up and resentful at having to take risks to help people whom he could only help once and on a very limited level. Does any of that sound...
Yeah, that's why I stopped going.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Those same kinds of issues?
Yep. That was it. That was it. Plus the fact that a lot of the people we were helping were coming and bombing the heck out of us.
were you thinking then that you were treating people who were either VC or VC sympathizers?
Oh, sure.
How did you know?
Well, you didn't know. I mean, that was the problem. But but for them to know a lot of the stuff about us, they would have had to have that kind of insight. So, yeah, you didn't. There was no way of knowing who the enemy was. But, yeah, you bet. So did I really feel like going out and helping people that probably were going to come back and do us harm? No, I wasn't as eager to do that. I really wasn't. I enjoyed doing it when I did it, but... Besides, I was an operating room nurse, and a lot of the stuff was general medicine. So I was not particularly talented in doing it.
Mm-hmm. But it also wasn't something you wanted to throw yourself into?
No, it didn't. No.
Okay. Did other nurses have some of the same feelings you did about it?
I don't know. I really didn't talk to the other nurses about it.
Okay. What did you guys do? What did you do specifically to relax? You've talked about hanging out at the Hooch, reading and stuff like that. Where would you get books?
Oh, people send me books. Or they'd be lying around. Somebody else would have a book, and I'd read it. I think you could buy books at the PX.
What kind of stuff did you like to read? Just whatever there was?
Yeah. I'd read anything. Read the labels of bottles. It didn't matter to me.
was it an escape or a relaxation?
Well, just fill the time, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That's mostly, you know, you're kind of a captive audience there. It's just a very small area that we stayed in, and it was just always something to fill the time, which either meant, hanging out in the Hooch, talking with your friends, going to a party. There were always parties going on, spending time with special people, you know, that kind of stuff.
You mentioned, partying and sometimes, you guys had a few drinks. How easily available was alcohol?
If you're a commander and you've got people in that kind of a situation, to my way of thinking, it's nice to give them as much free or low-cost booze as you can, because you'll keep them satisfied, basically, and then they'll be so hungover the next morning they're not going to complain about things. But I really do think that the use of alcohol in that way was a way of manipulating the people who worked. It was free. It was plentiful. I may say free. It was not necessarily free. It was free to the nurses for the most part, because everybody bought them drinks. But yes, it was plentiful and cheap.
Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by manipulation?
Well, I think when you have people in that type of a situation, you're going to have a lot of fear, disgruntlement, resentment, and all these kinds of things. And the booze pretty well just kept people happy. Or... not necessarily belligerent, let's put it that way.
Okay. What about the use of drugs? What did?
I think we preceded that pretty much.
Okay.
And I say that because I know that they had a staff meeting, which I didn't happen to go to that night, but where they brought in some marijuana and told people to try it so they would recognize it when they saw it. And I don't think it had been a problem really until after I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time I left in 67, it was pretty prevalent amongst the enlisted men. I do not know the use in the hospital per se.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw anybody use it. I still actually don't know what marijuana smells like.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, me either. And what about diversion of medical supplies like morphine? Did you hear of any of that?
The only thing that I knew was one of the operating room, actually it wasn't the operating room, she was in the central material supply, got nailed for stealing Demerol. But
kind of a drug is that for somebody?
That's a narcotic, a potent narcotic, up there with morphine.
Okay.
And but I think she was supplying some soldiers, and I don't know whether they were addicts that she was supplying or what she was doing, but she did get nailed, and I believe she was court-martialed.
And that happened while you were there?
Yeah, just as I was leaving. I really didn't know the details. I just know that there was people had reported that there was Demerol missing, and then they identified the nurse who was actually taking it.
Okay, and that was in 67, you're thinking?
67.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about another area that that certainly became more difficult as the war went on. But I wonder whether you saw anything along these lines in terms of tensions between blacks and whites or between Hispanics and blacks.
I did not see that. Now, okay. It doesn't mean that it didn't happen.
Yeah.
I did not see it.
You mentioned that you had an African-American supervisor.
Supervisor, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about her.
Oh, she's wonderful. She ran the OR. Let's see, she replaced me. Actually, I kind of ran the OR until she got there. She came in as a major and was promoted to lieutenant colonel. Fairly shortly.
What was her name?
Liz Like. Elizabeth, L-Y-K-E.
Mm-hmm.
And we all used to wear buttons that says, "We like Liz." She was just a delightful person. And we went and dragged her kicking and screaming out of her house when we went to the reunion down in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm. She lives down here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there was a group of people. I got down on my knees and just said, thank you for being such a... I mean, there aren't too many people I really would just get down on my knees in front of, and she's one of them.
Wow.
And that's how much I appreciated this gal. She's just a delightful individual, just real laid back and very caring, very sweet person, and certainly competent in what she did, but just a delight to work for. And we had a number of black people and Hispanics who worked with us, and I don't remember, I didn't see anything between nurses and enlisted men or doctors and enlisted men or
mm-hmm.
whatever in terms
right.
of race.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened in their own quarters, I can't tell you.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I do know that there was a gay guy who got the snort beat out of him. This was an enlisted man, and he got very, very badly beaten in his hooch. And also, there was I'm assuming he was gay, one of the male nurses that the doctors used to make fun of all the time, said that he'd make a good wife.
So, how did you know that the fellow who was beaten up badly was...
He told me.
I asked
him what happened.
He told you that he was gay?
No, he didn't. I said, are you gay? And he said no, but I'm sure he was.
Uh-huh. And do you know anything else about the incident?
No.
What were his injuries?
Oh, his facial injuries. Very, very. I mean, his face was just a disaster. Black eyes and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about the rest. I really didn't talk to him that much.
Mm-hmm.
He was an awfully nice fella.
Yeah.
Awfully nice.
And the nurse who probably was gay or was
yeah.
certainly seen that way. Can you tell me a little bit about the ridicule there?
Well, the doctors used to say, oh, blah, 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 he would make a wonderful wife. That's about all I heard.
Yeah.
You know.
Did that stuff bother you?
I don't like to see people made fun of, period.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever they are. Folks can't help what they are, whether it's the color of their skin or their who they were raised with or by or, you know, nationality or mm-hmm. probably their sexuality. I just don't like to see people made fun of.
Did any of that kind of thing ever come toward nurses who weren't making themselves, you know, sexually available? Oh, that must be a dyke or something like that. Did you ever hear anything?
I didn't
like
hear
that?
It, but I imagine it was said.
Mm-hmm.
I know that when my husband and I had talked about going, so, oh, you know what they say about nurses, and I thought, well, gee, that's just too bad, isn't it?
What do they say about nurses?
I don't know. Well, that's all he said. He didn't point out, but I'm sure that's what he meant.
He was alluding to the fact that, well, nurses must be lesbians?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that certainly was by no means the case.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as some of the stories you've told demonstrate quite clearly. Were there any lesbians that you know of?
I was not aware of any. I mean, probably there were people that I wasn't aware of until there was I've been there for quite a few months. There was a gal who moved into our hooch, a major, and she had this gal. I just kind of looked at this other woman and thought, boy, she looks like a football player. And they were inseparable, so I'm assuming that there was something going on
mm-hmm.
there. But, you know, to look for anything, no, not necessarily. And did I see any evidence of a lot of things going on between women? No, I saw a lot of blatant heterosexual activity.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see any. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, but I didn't see it, and I wasn't looking for it.
Right. Did any heat come down on the major and?
I have absolutely no idea.
Okay.
She didn't work in the OR, so
mm-hmm.
I didn't really get to know people outside the OR very much.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Beth, about letters back and forth and communication with home. Were you writing to anyone, maybe your mom or?
Sure.
How important were letters back and forth?
Very important. And then when the tapes, the small tape machines became really available, we used those as well. But yeah, we look forward to that. But stuff was sporadic. It might be a week or two before we get anything. And
mm-hmm.
I know that would be the way with my stuff going home.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised that a couple of my classmates were up to visit me last fall. They're going to be coming up again this fall. And
mm-hmm.
anyway, we hadn't really seen each other to sit down and talk since we graduated from nursing school. And they apparently kept my letters. So I thought that was kind of strange. But
no kidding.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
I know Mom kept all my letters.
Who else were you communicating with? Did you have friends?
Oh, sure. I had friends that I wrote to on a fairly regular basis. And
did you tell them
more than others?
And Beth, did you tell them what life was like there? Were you as it were, real with them, or did you not want to let people know so much about the harder edges?
Well, I think I was pretty realistic about it. I really don't remember saying that much, but
uh-huh.
apparently they thought I said a lot. I don't think they would have kept my letters. So
uh-huh.
I don't remember writing. I might say we were mortared or we had mass cows or something like that,
uh-huh.
Or it was really hot. And sometimes it was hard trying to get the dust and the bugs out of the letters before you sealed up the envelope.
Okay. You know? Yikes. Were you ever able to make a phone call home?
I did.
How'd that go?
That was pretty cool because you did it. It was a two-way radio, and it had to be patched through a number of places.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, you know, hi, how are you? Over.
Right, right.
I'm fine. How are you? Over.
Did you talk to your mom, or who'd you talk to?
Yeah, uh-huh. My mom and one of my friends who, mom and the one friend of mine used to both get on the phone, so go together to the place. And I can't remember how we did that. They had to go to a certain place, or
mm-hmm.
if they were both just at on a home phone. I can't remember.
Was it a good experience for you, or was it tough afterwards, or do you remember?
Oh, it was fine. It was wonderful being able to talk.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do it very often because as time went by, see, there weren't very many of us when I first went because I was there kind of in the beginning. And as more and more people came, there was more and more demand for that use of that Mars station. So,
yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I didn't want to yak on the phone when there were plenty of guys who really needed to
mm-hmm.
call home.
I see. Uh-huh. Tell me about that transition from your own transition from the 7th to when the 12th EVAC came in to Coochie. Were you, how did things change for you?
Well, rather dramatically, actually. At the 7th, I knew I was going to be temporary with the 7th
uh-huh.
and then be stationed with the 12th, and my job was going to be to set up the operating room. And I was asked to set up the two operating room Quonsets and the central material supply Quonset, which supplied the entire hospital. I didn't know anything about how to do any of that, and mm-hmm. and there was not an instruction manual,
right?
And nobody knew how to do it, and we weren't really taught how to do it,
right?
So
wow.
It was like, oh my God, now what do I do? And
yeah,
I did fly out to Tainan to look at the hospital out there.
Which one was it?
The 45th. Mm-hmm. It was a MUST hospital. I can't remember what that stood for, but it was the inflatable hospital.
Yeah.
Bad idea in a combat zone.
Yeah. The rubber, the yeah. big rubber. Well, and it was a bad idea. Why?
Well, not a good thing to have when you have mortars flying yeah. around because they just deflated.
Right. I could guess.
It was
but,
stupid.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, what can I say?
Right. So you flew out to see
just
what they were
doing.
Just
to look at it. Uh-huh. And that was a MASH hospital as well. I'd never really seen it in the back hospital, so I didn't have a clue. Fortunately, some of the guys knew more about what they were supposed to do, and I also was in charge of building, setting up one of the nurses' hooches and making sure it was ready for people to move in. So it was just like, my God, I don't have a clue. And I, given a team of men, had no idea. So I just relied very heavily on them and hoped that they wouldn't just destroy me and make fun of me and whatnot. But we wound up to be a real good working team.
Were these enlisted guys?
Yeah, they were
and,
enlisted guys.
Guys who had some longer experience?
Yeah, there were two guys, an African-American and a white guy who were both had quite a bit of experience, and they were wonderful. I just really relied on them very heavily. But the guys were, the younger fellows were very, very good to me, and they were known at the hospital as best boys, so, and that's how they always refer to themselves. So,
what were their names, if you can tell us?
Oh, Howie Corcimiglia, now dead, Corcimiglia. And he was really, really good. This is one of the guys who was with me at the 7th.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Schlicker, Schlicher. He was the white guy, the sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
The African American, I can't think of his name offhand. And if you
okay.
had asked me earlier, I could have found it or looked it up or
That's
something.
Okay. No
he
problem.
Was just a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, I'll just have to throw this one in
okay.
As an aside. I can see this guy's face just mm-hmm. as clearly as day. He was so funny and so nice. At any rate, I walk in one day and we're setting up the central material section, and these two guys are in there with some of the other enlisted men. And I said, I hopped up on the table where they're folding linen, and I says, "Okay, here I am, boys. $500 a pop." And the black guy pulls this wad of bills out of his pocket, would have choked a horse, and starts to count off $500 in small bills.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that they'd had payday. Whoops, all my stuff just fell on the floor. They had payday, and they gambled, played poker the night before.
Yeah, you should have maybe raised the price there a little. Just you didn't know it was within their price range. Yeah,
I slunk out the door. It was a while before I slunk back in again.
That was bold of you anyway.
Oh, well, of course they laughed.
I'm sure.
They excused me about that for a long time.
I'm sure.
It was pretty funny.
Yeah, and it's part of what you guys were also doing, ribbing each other and all that.
Oh,
I'm
all
sure.
the time.
I'm sure.
You bet.
How else could you survive,
sure.
really? Let me know, Beth, anything that you recall about working with or seeing Americans' allies, like, for example, Arvin. Did you ever have any interaction with Arvin medical personnel?
Not with medical personnel, but with regular Arvins. And one time, the boys and I took the boy. I shouldn't. Well, maybe I told this in the write up too. But the
okay.
way that I treated them was to take them into Coochie and pay for them to get something to eat and go to the whorehouse. So that was one of the reasons probably they were so good to me. But
you would pay for this?
Oh yeah.
Well, why would you do that?
Just as a treat. You have no idea how hard they worked for me. they just killed themselves. It was incredible. I just can't imagine that these guys would work so hard. But they did everything, anything I asked them to do, and they were just so gracious about it.
Mm-hmm.
And without any women around for them, you know, it was a treat. And some of them partook, and some of them didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was just. I mean, what are you going to give them? You know. So, anyway,
uh-huh.
So I'm down there one time, and I had, I can't remember who it was, one of the fellows was with me, and I don't remember if it was an enlisted man or an officer, but he was going to sell me for the equivalent of, like, $2.50 or something, I can't remember how many piastres it was, to an Arvin. then the Arvin starts peeling out this money too. Oh, this is bad.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean that's just black humor.
Yeah,
what
right.
Can I say?
Right, exactly. And
yeah.
The in Coochie Town.
Yeah.
The,
and that was in Coochie Town, by the way.
Okay. Uh-huh. There were no doubt numerous houses of prostitution and bars and all of that. Was that all in a certain sector of the town, or was it just all over the place?
It was pretty well all over the place. What I didn't realize in the beginning, and as we would go into town, there would be these signs for car wash alongside the road,
uh-huh.
and some shack, and a lot of the women did laundry, so you'd see fatigues and stuff hanging out on these clotheslines and all, but car wash. And I said, who's got any cars to wash? Well, it turns out that those were all little houses of ill repute, and there were a lot of them.
Okay, but that was just like code or something.
Yeah, mm-hmm. sort of. I said, well, where are all the cars? And then somebody said, well, you idiot. You know, those are whorehouses. And then they had the ones downtown. There was one called the Mono Queen, and the girls all had their numbers on a fan, and the guys would go up. It was all enclosed in chicken wire, and they'd go up and pick out their girl by the number.
Did you ever see these Vietnamese women?
Oh, yeah. Actually, in my film, I've got nice pictures of them,
mm-hmm.
really good pictures.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any feelings about what they were doing to survive, basically?
No, that's what they did to survive.
Okay.
Except they were so young.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my word. Some of those kids were teenagers, you know. Didn't look like they were more than 12 or 13.
Yeah. And was that a bit upsetting on some level?
No, it's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it happens with every war.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
Yeah.
That's certainly true.
Yeah, you just look at it and say, okay, well.
how important was music for you? Did you guys have a lot of music?
Yeah. My surgeon friend and I would sit out every evening and listen to what was called music by candlelight, which you guys now would call elevator music and probably barf at. But we really enjoyed it, and we'd sit out and have our little chair out in the dirt at night,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and listen to that. I can't remember how long the program was on, for an hour or something like that. So we usually have a glass of wine or something and just sit there and relax. And then, of course, when you went out to party with the guys, they had jukeboxes and whatnot. And everybody got these Akai tape recorders. That was the thing to get. And,
mm-hmm.
and then they get tapes from home. So there was always music. And, yes, it was very important.
Any songs that when you hear them make you like go to Coochie immediately?
Yep. House of the Rising Sun, that was one of their favorites. A lot of times when I hear Mamas and the Papas with Monday Monday, that one always brings it up. Windy was one that I remember, and My Big Red Balloon, Would You Like to Fly, and my, you know, whatever it was.
Right.
The Association, I guess. Anyway, those are the ones that for me, most readily come to mind.
You did have an R&R, is that right?
I did.
Okay, where did you go, and how did that go?
Well, we used to sneak out a lot. This is before they put the kibosh on it after a nurse got killed, but we used to sneak out a lot and go up to Coochie or Vung Tau, not Coochie, to Saigon or to Vung Tau, and especially Vung Tau, which had a wonderful beach. And I took an R&R to, where the heck did we go? Did I go to Vung Tau and R&R? Pretty bad. I can't even remember.
That would have been like where all the Australians were and all?
Yeah. I guess Vung Tau was our R&R. I went to Thailand on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, I take it back. I went to Thailand and I went to Penang in Malaysia on R&R.
Okay.
These others were just side trips,
mm-hmm.
sneaking out and going and having fun before they stopped people from being able to do that.
And you mentioned the nurse being killed. What's that reference?
I don't remember who that was. Somebody up north, but that was the excuse they gave us at the hospital when they said, you gals can't go out and fly around anymore like you're doing. You can't go out and drive tanks or all the things that we see. Being one of the only women there, you could do anything. The fellows would let you fly their planes and drive their tanks and their helicopters or whatever it was.
And were you pretty much doing this kind of stuff then?
Oh, yeah.
You would get off base and with no, am I right in thinking you had no security detail or anything with you?
You bet.
We
just snuck out.
Would you, like, grab a Jeep and just go?
Well, usually it was one of the fellows that had the Jeep, or it might be somebody that you knew, and generally somebody knew where you were. Your chief nurse may or may not. but some of your friends would know that sure. you were going out in case you didn't come back.
Right. Buddy system, that kind of thing.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about going to Penang to on R&R. How long were you there?
Penang was 1 week.
Okay. What did you do?
Stayed on the beach, mm-hmm. and there's a little motel type of dealie right on the beach, and we'd go out and eat on the beach and swim and walk around, and we went up to, I remember one time, I can't remember how we did this, but we drove up to, it was a place up in the mountains, and it was a beautiful rainforest area, and it was clean, and the real modern building and everything. I don't remember exactly what that was, but most of the time we just stayed around on the beach. We ate and drank and slept.
Was this primarily for nurses or exclusively for nurses?
No, it was me and my surgeon friend.
Okay. And so you were there for a week.
Mm-hmm.
Was it tough going back to Kuchi?
I would just as soon have stayed there for the rest of my life. He was eager to get back to work,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
as he was a very dedicated surgeon. And, he once he got rested, but he got really sick, and I practically had to carry him back to Kuchi.
Like food poisoning sick, or?
I guess. It was like the flu or something. He was running a temperature and chills, and he could barely walk.
It was a mess.
When we went back, yeah, because we'd gone out one day, and I bought a whole bunch of equipment. I wanted to get my tape recorder and a camera and all, and so I thought he was going to be able to help carry that stuff back, and he couldn't. I had to lug it all and him.
Right. Yeah, that's not a good way for any kind of break to end.
Yeah.
But he recovered all right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. Did you ever figure out what it was?
No.
We just said
some flu or something.
Fever of unknown origin kind
yeah.
of thing. And you also had a little bit of time in Thailand, you mentioned?
Yeah, a couple of weeks in Thailand.
Whereabouts?
Bangkok.
Okay.
And then we traveled out, used that as a base and traveled.
Did you go up north in Thailand?
Not far.
As far as Chiang Mai?
No.
Okay. How did you get around?
We hired a guy who is a driver for $20 and a carton of cigarettes.
And
he was back and call for 2 weeks.
And he was yours for 2 weeks?
He was. Any place, any time, whatever, morning till night.
Wow. How did you know where to go?
Oh, I don't know. He told us a lot.
Okay.
I can't remember. We drove around. I don't remember how we did this. We must have gotten the cab. Maybe it was him who picked us up at the airport. That's probably what happened. He probably picked us up at the airport, mm-hmm. and we asked about a place to stay, and we went to this motel, and it was very nice. It had a pool and all that kind of stuff and a nice restaurant. And then I think that's when we bargained with him to be our person, our driver for the next 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was that a good time in Thailand? Did you learn anything about Thailand or the Thai people?
I loved the Thai people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that they had the political unrest at that time, but we could go any place and do anything. It was extremely safe, and the Thai people were so gracious and so nice. They were just absolutely delightful. I never felt uncomfortable while I was there. I could have lived there forever.
Mm-hmm.
It would not have bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
On the way back, we missed the flight back to Vietnam, and so we stayed with him and his family. He and his wife got out of their bed, and there were three of us, and we piled into their bed.
No kidding! Wow.
Yeah, two girls and a guy.
That's amazing.
It was, and what I said to him the next morning, his name was Prayun, and I said, Prayun, aren't you afraid that somebody would just kill you and steal everything that you have? And he said, no. He said, we Thais believe that you come into the world with nothing and we leave with nothing, and so everything that we do that's good, we do right while we're here, and we don't worry. And I was so impressed by that, and I've never forgotten it. The gal who was on that trip asked me, was at the down in Washington here back in November, and she mm-hmm. asked me if I remembered that, and I said, you bet I do. It's been one of my guiding principles ever since that day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's something that Americans need to work a little harder on,
yeah,
I think.
You bet.
I certainly do. Beth, tell me about attending a Bob Hope show. I gather that you did have an opportunity to do that.
You bet.
When was that?
It was on the 25th of December, 25th anniversary of the 1966, 25th mm-hmm. anniversary of the 25th Infantry Division, and it was 2 days before my 25th birthday.
Wow, that's a lot of 25s in there.
You bet.
So Christmas Day, and where was it?
It was held at the Lightning Bowl on the 25th Infantry Division over by headquarters.
Mm-hmm. Where were you in relation to the stage, and what did you see?
Right up in front of the stage, a little bit off to the right.
I figured.
Uh-huh. Well, they were, you know, the guys were pretty good about letting the girls do that.
That's what I thought, yeah. And what kind of entertainment was it? Did you enjoy it? Was it weird? I mean, what was it like?
Well, I'd really been looking forward to this big time, and it was really good. The people who performed were Joey Heatherton, who was a singer, dancer.
Sure.
At that time. I didn't even know who she was.
Mm-hmm.
Phyllis Diller and Anita Bryant, Jerry Colonna, Les Brown and his Band of Renown.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that shocked me a little bit was that I did not realize that Bob Hope did not perform without cues, and he had an electronic cue board, so every word that he said was up on the cue card. And it was like, holy cow, he can't even, I can't remember if it was electronic actually now or not, but every word that he said was programmed. His delivery was wonderful, but I was kind of disappointed at that, because I could turn around and watch everything that he was reading as he did it.
It was sort of like in Wizard of Oz, looking behind the curtain.
The
guy operating it takes away the mystery, sort of thing.
In a way, but he always seemed to me to be ad-libbing prior to that, and there was nothing that was ad-libbed. Even the ad-libs were programmed, and that surprised me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great show. I enjoyed it. There were a zillion guys there.
Yeah.
Pete Kama told me years later that. While we were having that celebration up top, the word was that the VC were having as big, if not larger, entertainment right beneath our feet. We were making so much noise, we didn't know it.
Wow. In some kind of amphitheater in the tunnel complex of some kind?
That's what they said.
How'd that make you feel?
Well, of course, I didn't know about it at the
sure,
time. But
of course.
Again, it's sort of like... Well, a combination, a little bit of being violated.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we were violating them.
Mm.
A little bit of awe about how they could do this. And it's just, wow, this is so cool. And then a thought of, gee, we were really in more danger than we realized all the time. And we were kind of stupid.
Yeah, the danger part is the thing that's, to me, so remarkable. I mean, they were, you know, enemies so close.
Yeah.
And at a time when everybody was kind of, you know, the Americans were... relaxing and hanging loose and unaware, I guess.
But I think stuff like that happens every day in one form or another,
mm-hmm.
and we just go along our own merry way, completely oblivious to all the stuff that's happening around us.
And maybe that's to the good, the oblivious part.
You bet.
When your tour was sort of coming toward its end, what thoughts were you giving to the possibility of staying on in Vietnam?
Oh, I had no thoughts at all. Oh, by the way, I want to interject something
here. Of course.
The dean of the college where I work asked me, after she had seen my film, what was it that allowed me to survive in that situation? And I replied, stupidity. So when we talk about being naive or oblivious to what's going on, I really think that works to our favor.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a problem for me at all. I think people drive themselves nuts when they know too much or they worry too much. I don't worry at all about anything. Never have, never will, because it's a waste of energy. In terms of leaving Vietnam, I really couldn't wait to get out. And the reason was this, not so much because of the danger. Part of it was because my surgeon friend had already rotated back, as had most of the people with whom I've been very, very close.
Because
I came in by myself and... there were folks who were there when I got there, and folks who all started coming in after I had arrived. But it was kind of in between. I was the only person who was there for just that amount of time. And the things that I had started when we really had no rules or regulations,
yes.
and we were flying by the seat of our pants,
uh-huh.
all that had gone by the by. And now we were being ruled and regulated to death. Which I didn't like. I liked the having to improvise with everything, fly by the seat of my pants, do what it took to really make things work, and all of that was going by the by as really civilization moved in.
Things were getting more micromanaged.
Very much micromanaged. Uh-huh. By that time, they had brought in flush toilets just before I left.
Wow.
Sidewalks, you know, all these other kinds of things that were just like, holy cow. Now I liked it the way it was when I got there, and we were just, you know, there was nothing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the pieces that had worked for you were starting to be taken away or falling away in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how long was your enlistment agreement for?
For 2 years, but I wanted to go to Germany as my guaranteed assignment.
Okay.
I think people who knew me and my surgeon friend were trying to be good to us, and they assigned us both to Valley Forge, and I said, no, I really didn't want to do that. I want to go to Germany. So I opted out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And did go to Germany. And because that was a two-year tour of duty, I had to extend to complete that tour.
And so where were you in Germany then?
I was in Landstuhl.
And with what unit?
2nd General Hospital.
Okay. As an OR nurse again?
As an OR nurse.
And from when did you actually leave Vietnam then?
I left in October of 1966 and then went to...
67,
I'm sorry.
Uh-huh,
thank
uh-huh.
you.
That's fine.
Took 30 days, I think it was, of leave, and then went over to Germany.
Okay.
And then did 2 years there, got out in, I think it was December 29th of 1969, and stayed on as a civilian until August. But they wouldn't let me work in the operating room.
Were you ever tempted to just stay in and become a career person?
Well, I was kind of on the fast track, and I'd only been in the service for a couple of years when they wanted to promote me to major, but that would have meant they could have pulled me back out and sent me back over to Vietnam in charge of a MASH hospital, and I said, I don't think so. I'm a happy civilian at heart. I can't play these games, so... What I should add on to that is that they had, when I was working at 2nd General, I lived on the economy, but you weren't supposed to go more than 100 miles from the base at any given time, and you had to tell them where you were going at all times, and you had to be around on weekends so that if they did an alert, one of these practice things, that you were there. And I just wanted to be there to travel, so I was gone all the time, and fortunately nobody ever bothered me. They
mm-hmm.
caught one of the nurses and court-martialed her.
For
leaving and not having permission. She went to Berlin.
Okay. They court-martialed her?
They court-martialed her. She was a major. And I thought, uh-oh. But they really liked me, and they were very good to me, and nobody ever questioned me about all these trips that I took.
So you're sort of walking between the cracks there?
I was walking between the cracks.
Uh-huh.
And I was on the fast track. As I said, they would have promoted me right up the line.
But you were really adamant that you weren't going back to Vietnam?
I didn't want to go back, no. One of the things that they were going to do was pull me out. I think it was in, like, February. It was not long after I had gotten there, and they were going to pull me out and send me to the Middle East because Israel was
mm-hmm.
having a little thingy.
Yeah, there was a little war going on.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And I said, I am not going to die for people who are going to be fighting for 1,000 years. They've been fighting for 1,000 years up until now, and they're going to keep on fighting, and I'm just not going to die for that. So that was the type of thing that concerned me.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And... how much attention were you paying it when you were in Germany to the escalation in Vietnam?
Not much. When I first left, I was really concerned about the people I had left because we knew Tet was coming. The people who tell you that they weren't aware that Tet was going to be the way it was, I knew, and I knew very little about anything, but I knew that Tet was going to be bad.
How did you know that was...
Well, everybody, it was common knowledge, I thought, on the base. That was going to be a horrendous event, and I was just thrilled to be able to get out of there and very worried about my colleagues. But I had been told by a lot of my friends, soldiers, that this was going to be a big one.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. And how were you able to get information about what happened? When Tet actually occurred, you must have been, you know, pretty concerned.
Yeah, there was a girl who came actually two of them who had been stationed with me who came, who got out of Vietnam and came over to Second General.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew them. I didn't know them well.
Right.
But they told me
you had
what
some,
had happened.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What kinds of things did you hear? Do you recall at all?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Just that it was awful and they got rocketed and mortared. And, but I don't think any of the people I knew got hurt or killed.
Right. But that it was rough.
It was nasty, yeah.
Yeah. When you actually separated from the service in 69, you said that you stayed in Germany as a civilian for a little while.
8 months.
Okay, 8 months. Working at the same hospital?
Yep.
And did your duties change at all when you transitioned?
Yeah, I wanted to stay in the OR. That's what I do, and I did it well. But they had a policy that civilians couldn't work in the OR. Now, there was a gal who was in the service and working in the OR before I got there.
Yeah.
And her husband was due to rotate back a couple of months after she was. So she, or maybe it was 4 months, I can't remember. So she lobbied hard to get a job in the OR. And they said, no, you can't have it. We can't pay you for all your overtime. We can't pay you for your call. You're going to complain. And that's going to be not a good situation. And so, no, we don't want you there. So she lobbied really, really hard with the physicians and higher ups that she knew, and she got the job. And of course, within a month, she was bitching and complaining.
Mm-hmm.
So she ruined it for me. And they said there will never be another civilian in the OR. Oh. So they put me up on the wards, and I was not happy.
That
at
whole
all.
Precedent thing, that
yeah.
mindless precedent.
Yeah.
We'll see it happen over there. So, yeah, that's kind of crazy making. They put you on the wards, which made you very unhappy.
Oh well, I'm not a ward nurse.
Yeah,
I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. I wasn't up on. I'd never done any floor of duty nursing after the first 6 months of graduation.
Yeah.
And I just was really uncomfortable. And they expected me to do all kinds of things I'd never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't what I did. And I was really good as an OR nurse, and I just felt totally incompetent, and I'm sure they felt it as well.
It just wasn't a viable work setup.
No, not for me.
Yeah.
I never, and they had me on nights and evenings, and nights just, I can't do it. I don't sleep well. So it was not comfortable for me at all.
Did that sort of make your decision both to leave the Second General and to leave Germany?
No, I only planned to stay until I could complete a few of the trips. So I had not intended to stay past August anyway.
Okay. Uh-huh. What was the next step for you?
I came back to the States. I wanted to get warm and move to Florida.
Whereabouts in Florida?
Clearwater.
Okay, very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so, and how did you go from there to Maine? Was there an intermediate step?
Yeah, when I was in Florida, again, I couldn't get a job in the OR. I just wanted to live in Florida for a while. I always wanted to
you couldn't,
try that
wait,
out.
You couldn't get a job?
In the OR.
Okay, that's bizarre.
Well, they had a waiting list as long as your arm. By that time,
bad.
I think people figured out that OR is a pretty nice job if you can get it.
Okay, well.
And, so they said, yeah, I put your name in, but we've got, I don't know, 33 people ahead of you or whatever it was.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, brother.
Yeah.
So I worked on the floors again for a few months, and I said, I can't do this. I was on evenings and nights mostly, and I said, that's it. So mm-hmm. I got out of nursing and went back to college on GI Bill. So I did my first 2 years down there and then decided I would go up to North Carolina. I thought I would go to Duke University. I didn't have a chance to apply because I was doubling up on my courses. I went through 2 years and 14 months, I think it was. So I waited until I got out of there before I even decided to apply someplace else. Went up, took a look at Duke, didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Went to, can't think of the name of the other college. Applied, got in, didn't really want to go there. And the one I liked was Wake Forest. I went and fell in love with the campus. But they were full, and they said, what you'll have to do is put in your application, and you'll have to wait. Somebody will be dropping out by midterm, and we'll be able to take you.
Uh-huh.
So,
is that how it worked out?
Yeah.
Okay. So you finished at Wake Forest.
At Wake Forest.
And what was the degree actually in?
It was in biology, but that was actually their pre-med degree.
Were you thinking that you'd go to medical school?
No, I didn't. Here I am thinking, again, women can only be nurse, secretary, teacher, housewife. They had made us take a battery of tests before we left,
mm-hmm.
or they wouldn't give you your diploma. So I'm sitting there, it's a bunch of practice GREs for graduate school,
yeah.
and also a battery of psychological tests. And this girl sitting next to me, who had not been a very good student and her grades were kind of lousy, and I said, well, man, what are you going to do now that you're graduating? And she said, I'm going to medical school. Well, geez, my jaw must have hit my knees. And I said, where? She said, here, I've already been accepted. Well, if I had realized, I think I would have stayed on and tried to get into medical school. My grades were much better than, I guess, most of the kids who got in.
It just never occurred to you?
Nope.
I mean,
didn't realize that a woman could do it.
And this would have been sometime in, like, 74 or something like
yep,
that?
Yep, 74. Now, you have to understand that the whole time I was in Washington, with Georgetown, George Washington, Howard Universities, all these other big places that affiliated with us, there was not one female. I take it back, there was one. Her name was Ruth Jacoby, and she was a neurosurgeon, and she brought in one female resident with her. That was the only woman doctor, actually two doctors then, that I ever saw. Ever. So
there
weren't any.
Yeah.
I never saw one anywhere, not in any of the hospitals that I'd worked at, even in Clearwater. So I had never seen a woman doctor. So I didn't know you could do it. I thought it was, first of all, I knew it was going to be expensive.
Yes.
But I just figured it would be impossible. And so it never even crossed my mind. So I've had pangs about that ever since, but I'm fine.
Yeah, you've come through that. What was your plan? Would it be BS in biology then?
Well, it was actually BA.
Oh, BA,
funny enough, if you can believe this, because it's different every place that you go, that was their research degree. In many other places, it's the other way around.
Sure.
But whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So... did I know what I was going to do? I really didn't. I knew after I left Wake Forest I wanted to do something with biology and preferably with behavior and something with vertebrates. And so I was thinking seriously of doing something with marine mammals, although I get horribly seasick. So that kind of
pushed
that a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And so I just kind of scouted. And I was looking at some of the Ivy League colleges. I also looked at doing some of the wildlife stuff out west. And on a whim, when I came up to look at the University of New Hampshire, didn't care for that campus either, and just drove up here into Maine to the University of Maine at Orono, which I'd never seen, never heard of either, and fell in love with the place. So I applied, came as a special student for a semester, and got in. Had to wait to take my GREs that fall. But got in and won a university fellowship. They only offer two for the whole university, so I was really fortunate. And between that and the GI Bill, I was okay financially.
And how long were you a student there?
Well, the master's program was actually 2 years, but I did coyote research. So I came in 74 and really didn't get into school until 75 and had to do some background courses.
Mm-hmm.
Because I hadn't had any background courses that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And had to wait for my animals to breed. So it was actually 79 before I finished the master's program.
And did you decide to continue for a PhD?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My PhD actually, that's an EDD, and that's in educational administration.
Okay. And did that follow right on? Did you continue?
No, I took the job with the University of Maine. I was actually going to be a writer and had started that and then realized it was sort of like picking crabs. I don't know if you ever pick crabs or not.
No, but I've tried to be a writer.
We have to talk about that.
Yeah.
By the time I pick a crab, I've expended so much energy, I'm about ready to starve. Mm-hmm. So, and writing to me was a little like that. I've always been able to publish everything that I've written, but I was a slow writer. So I took this job just thinking it would be nice to have a regular paycheck. And benefits, and then I could write on the side. Well, the job kept me so busy. Hours were horrendous, and I never had a chance to really write. So I'm actually looking forward to going back and doing that. Anyway, because I was a faculty member, the university waives the tuition, so I was able to get my doctorate while I was working.
And what year was it awarded?
1991, I think.
1991, okay. But you've had faculty status since, am I right in thinking, 79?
No, 80? Faculty status 81.
81, okay.
Yeah. I took a year off. Actually, it would be 14 months, I guess. I didn't work. I wanted to remodel my house, which I did myself.
Oh, you did it yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Any help?
No.
Besides, like, you know, the hardware store?
No. There were a couple of things that that I had a couple of men take care of,
mm-hmm.
but most
mm-hmm.
of it I did on my own.
Wow, that's astounding. That's amazing. Boy, a writer who can do plumbing, boy, that just doesn't happen that
well,
right.
Plumbing and I don't get along.
Oh, okay, well, I picked the one area.
When I said I had to have a couple of guys do something.
Oh, okay.
That was one of them.
I was going to say, leave it to me to find the one. But
I can help with that and electricity, but I do not do them on my own, and I'm not a great carpenter, but I do good finish work.
There you go. Well, it's all in the presentation, really.
Yeah.
Beth, tell me about the film project that you've developed. You referred to it once, and you and I have talked about it, but for someone who doesn't have any background, can you just explain what you've done?
Sure. I think like so many other people who were in Vietnam, we took pictures, and I looked at them at the time and threw them in a box and really didn't look at them again. And every place that I moved, they just stayed in a box, and I stuffed them in a closet, take them with me.
Mm-hmm.
But I really never looked at them again. And back in 1990, I think it was, I went on sabbatical, and I wanted to write a book. And I thought, well, gee, I've got these wonderful pictures. At least I thought they were pretty good. I'll take a look at those and use those as a basis for writing. And I started doing that. So it was the first time I had ever looked at them. And then when the sabbatical was up, and I had written my dissertation and all, too, so I just didn't finish the book and threw the stuff back up in the attic and didn't look at it again.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to the reunion in Texas, I think it must have been 98 or 99, for the 12th EVAC, they had invited us to bring our pictures. Well, I'd won a national award and had to go to a conference in Denver to pick that up.
What award was it?
It's called the Distinguished Service Award.
Awarded by?
National Association of 4-H
mm-hmm.
agents or something like that. Okay. NAE 4-HA, Extension 4-H agents. Mm-hmm. So anyway, because I was going to go out anyway, I had a couple of neighbors who wanted to go out with me. We did some traveling out west, and there was no way I was going to carry slides and stuff around with me because I'd get damaged or lost or whatever. So I didn't bring anything with me. And when we went to the reunion, we had an evening where people shared slides or films that they'd taken.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the stuff and I thought, gosh, my stuff's at least that good, if not a heck of a lot better. So I decided that I would that I would do a film when I got home. And as it turned out, trying to get home was not the easiest thing. The shuttle was late coming to get me, and apparently for everybody else, too, and most other people had just given up and taken a cab. But the shuttle guy didn't know that, so he'd get out at each place, and by the time we got to the airport, I missed my plane.
Oh, boy.
Which was not a good thing. And I had the flu. So I'm sitting in there with a raging temperature and no flight, and half in and half out of it, listening to music, and I heard some music I liked. So I bought one of the CDs and came back up and liked the CD so much, I wound up buying a couple of more on the Internet from this particular artist.
Mm-hmm.
And then thought, geez, I'll write a grant. I'm too cheap to do this on my own. So I wrote a grant to the Women in Curriculum at the University of Maine. They had a $3,000 limit, and I got the $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just going to put together a little film to bring down for this reunion that's coming up in November 2004.
This year, 2004. Uh-huh.
And as I started working on this thing, I just became obsessed with it. And the more that I worked on it, the more I realized I had something very special. And so I just continued doing it, even though it cost me several thousand out of my own pocket. But I put together a film that is 43 minutes long. People who see it are just blown away by it. In fact, I'm showing it tomorrow to a group of nurses on campus.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
The problem was, because I think that there's, from everybody who's seen it really likes the film. And I've been told by a producer here in Maine who would cost me, close to $40,000 to have them produce it, that she feels that it should be entered into art film competition, and that she feels that it would qualify for an Oscar in a special film category. I don't know if that's true or not, but they were pretty excited about it. I just couldn't afford to pay them to do that type of thing.
The front money that it
Yeah, costs. And I could not get, and the reason I was going to have to pay them is that I could not get the rights to the music that I used, and I built the film on the music.
So the music, which is not within your control legally, is central to the film's design?
Okay. Exactly.
Yeah.
In fact, when you see it, you'll understand.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. Yeah.
In fact, I was debating on whether I ought to just go ahead and send it on down to you or not. And
well, we can talk
hope
about,
I don't get sued.
We can talk about that. And,
yeah.
And nothing illegal will happen, she said for the record. But it's something that you're continuing to pursue in terms of the possibilities for a release
Exactly. And I had gotten a contract with what they call a needle drop company. They've got offices in Hollywood and New York where you can purchase music, and it's a lot of stuff that's used for Hollywood films. And I could not find anything I wanted. I like vocals on it. Most of the stuff that they have is simply instrumental. As I was, and this was just this spring here, a couple of months ago, there were some artists who came down from Canada who were folk singers that I'd heard before and really liked. Found out that they were going to be performing down here, a couple hours drive from where I am, mm-hmm. on a Friday evening, and I was just too tired to go down. But I did talk with the promoter who had them coming down. They were doing a benefit concert, and asked him if he would talk with them, and he said he would, and he just broached the subject with them. So after they left, I showed him the film, and he said, oh, yeah. He says, we've got to get this thing produced, and he says, I think they'll do the music for you. So he says, I'll make the contact, and then you can work directly with them. Well, he made the contact, or left messages, and he's never heard back from them. And so finally he just says, well, they're not answering my phone calls. So I said, well, is there a way that I can call them directly? And he's not answered my voicemails either, so I guess he's given up on it. Now I've got to find somebody else. I really thought they'd be wonderful, but if I can't make contact, I can't make contact.
Mm-hmm. Right. How committed are you to having the film appear in the form in which you want it to appear?
Well, I think there would have to be some modifications. It's still my film, and I would like to be able to maintain that integrity of it, because there is a message there. And that was one of the issues for me with the folks who wanted to get it out in the mm-hmm. film festival circuit. She wanted to do actually two versions of it. One was going to be really cut down, but I do want control over how that is used. It is my material.
Mm-hmm.
How open I am, it depends on what it is.
Okay.
There's a guy who pushed the buttons, and we were always fighting over stuff, and I always won, almost always won. and he admitted after it was all done that I was right in those decisions. So.
These are artistic decisions.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. But you'd have to see it. And
okay.
You know, anybody who looks at it or anybody who works on it, their view is going to be very different from mine.
Yeah, sure.
So.
What message does it have? If you can just, I know that this is going to be different, again, for every viewer, because that's the kind of medium that it is. But what does it say to you?
My goal in producing this film was that people who were stationed with me at Coochee at that time that I was there would look at this film and say, yes, that's exactly what it was like. And that was all I was trying to do. What I did do with it is organize it into categories, and it starts off with just Welcome to Vietnam, then there's the hospitals going into the town of Coochee, off to war, the operating room, there's a section on R&R, you know, get me out of here kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole section on just showing Vietnam, you know, I entitled it The Innocents. It's just showing the people. Oh, there's Airstrike. That was the other, because I got to go up in the plane and all. And there's, so it's a mixture of slides and live action.
Mm-hmm.
But it just shows what it was like. And so I was... Ken Hickman, who donated some of the films, Howie Korchemelia's son, Howie's dead now, but Howie Korchemelia's son donated some Super 8 movies, as did Ken Hickman, who was a nurse anesthetist.
Mm-hmm.
And when Ken looked at it, I took it out, I went to Alaska and stopped off in Seattle, and he came to visit me, and I showed him the film, and without any prompting at all, he said, yes, that's exactly what it was like. So that made me feel really good.
Yeah, mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah.
So I try to be very unbiased, and I think I took every good shot I had, whether it was a movie clip or a slide, and just organized them and let her run.
Mm-hmm.